and, being on the whole such infinitely superior entities to us mere humans, their choices cause much speculation. This is perhaps why Earth Central named itself thus. The meaning of its name is simple to understand, and only in the convolutions of the most twisted and paranoid brain capable of evoking any layers of conspiratorial meaning. Similarly, the runcible AIs usually take on only the names of the planets they govern. However, for ship AIs, through a fictional tradition hailing back towards the end of the last millennium, things are very different. Many warships will take on names consistent with their task. So there are endless vessels bearing the names of military figures or ancient battles. But still, one might be driven to wonder about the arrogance of an AI calling itself Napoleon, or the double meaning inherent in a ship called Napoleon the Pig. Other choices for the names of ships are equally interesting, not to say worrying. For instance, Caligula, Titanic 7, Stellar Suppository, and Jack Ketch. And what must one think of a sector-class AI embodied in a giant research vessel whose sole purpose is to investigate the artifacts left by ancient extinct races, which chooses to call itself Jerusalem? From Quince Guide, compiled by humans. For Mr. Crane, there was as little distinction between conscious and unconscious as there was for him between his internal and external worlds. They were mangled, fractured, and disjointed in time as in meaning, structured only by imposed imperatives and a chaotic striving for unity. Therefore, Crane walked through the valley of shadow, and, in the light of another sun, tracked bloody footprints. Inset in white carapace, faceted sapphire eyes mirrored the etched sapphires a man tried to use to buy his life. Some pattern recognition program keyed with his orders and caused him to temporarily understand that the presence of another two albino creatures awaiting him was no random, natural event. He halted and studied them, while shoving stones, just like their eyes, down a man's throat. These creatures stood on six legs, were much larger than the previous two, and, as on another occasion, one of them scuttled aside to act as a spotter. Crane fell back to a kind of order, pulled up his sleeves, straightened his hat, and advanced. The remaining creature lifted its head, huge pincers clacking and carapace sores rubbing against each other to grind their teeth back to sharpness, lubricant squirting from the glands at either side of its nightmare mouth. Then it opened both sets of implements wide and charged, kicking up blue-green leaves as it came. Crane stood with his feet braced and his arms open wide, as if intending to meet the creature like a sumo wrestler facing his opponent. When it was only a few paces away from him, he ducked low, his head slipping underneath its head and forward segments. Its momentum carrying it on over him, he abruptly jerked upright. Half a ton of enraged slear went tail overhead and slammed down on its back behind him, its six legs kicking at the air and its mouth bubbling. He glanced back at it once, straightened his hat, and continued up the canyon. He didn't need to look round to know what happened next. He could hear the creature struggling to regain its feet, shaking itself, then charging him again, issuing a sound like a fractured air hose. Of course, being what he was, he could calculate its position relative to himself just by listening. Like a bullfighter, he stepped aside at precisely the right moment, reached out, grabbed, pulled down, and twisted. This time, the sleer hit the ground on its side, minus one of its pincers, which Crane now held. Again, it struggled to its feet and swung towards him. Had Mr. Crane possessed a voice, he would have then sighed. The other sleer quickly scuttled down from its rock and headed away, as before. The stunned sleer's next attack was its last. Mr. Crane walked on, sane, insane, neutral. Retroact 13. Parts of the Golem 25 screamed as the memcording of Serban Klein began to load. Had he been whole, his base programming, empathy, and morality, which barred him from choosing to kill without justifiable cause and prevented any pleasure in the act, would have been warped by a paradox that the memcording created. He had tortured and killed for the thrill of power and twisted psychotic pleasure, for the Serban Klein memcording was now becoming his own memory. On a purely logical level, the screaming parts of him tried to fight the memory, deny it, but it was just too strong. And no matter how much of it those parts deleted, yet more was downloaded. His base programming should have broken, his mind essentially erased, but as he had existed from the moment Pendle had tampered with his mind, this was the programming equivalent of trying to burn ash. When it seemed he should lose himself completely, it was the damage caused by Pendle's sabotage of him that now saved him. Using the program designed to drive him schizophrenic, the Golem began to fully and permanently partition his mind, erecting barriers and creating separate little enclaves of self, 17 of them. The result would apparently be what his tormentors required. He would be a killing machine and would obey the orders given by his new owners. But without the Serban Klein download continuing to feed into him, at those times when he was not under direct orders, he would be free to try and reconnect those 17 elements of himself and regain sanity, autonomy. He would not be able to do this consciously, however, nor entirely by internal reformatting. In setting up the required program that would select 17 iconic representations of those separate parts of his mind and then order them in random but unrepeating combinations, his remaining self fragmented into oblivion, knowing that the first combination could be the right one, just as could be the 10 millionth. It might take only a few hours to hit upon, or it could take 1,000 years. The killing machine opened his eyes and immediately focused on the small rubber dog that was fixed on the upper edge of Starlek's console screen. Number 1. not knowing why it was so essential he take possession of that small, innocuous object, the golem awaited his orders. While he waited, he noticed that the clamps securing him to the chair were gone, as had all his synth skin. "You sure it's safe?" the birdman asked. "Oh, yes," said Starlek. "Golem, stand up." The golem stood, held out his hand, and inspected the components of his fingers as he closed that same hand into a fist and opened it again. This seemed to disconcert Starlek, who began checking through some programming code on his console's screen. "Golem, lower your hand and remain motionless." The golem obeyed. The birdman wheeled his laden trolley over and looked up at the machine. "Tall fucker, ain't he? Sure gonna scare the shit out of whoever he sent after," the man said. "What should we call him?" "Well, I thought Mr. Longshanks, but let's leave it for him to decide." "Golem, what shall we name you?" said Starlek. The golem tried to speak, but his partitioning of his own mind had made voice operation inaccessible to him. "Damn," said Starlek, "we've lost his voice. No matter, the only response they'll want from him is obedience. Golem, what is your name?" In its confusion, the golem could put together only two disparate facts: that he had recently been Longshanks, and that a birdman was staring at him. Stork, Heron, Flamingo, Crane. Just getting up a list of related words. He's obviously keying off your appearance with the idea of him being long-limbed. Heron is a good one, but then again, I think we'll call him Crane. A touch of double meaning there, relating to machinery, don't you think? The birdman had now lost interest and was beginning his work. Now the golem, Crane, noted, through internal diagnostics, the sequential removal of all his joint motors, which the birdman then replaced with other motors. The feed from Starlek's console told Crane that these were adapted industrial torque motors. To compensate for the power drain of such excessively powerful machinery, the birdman attached in parallel a further three micropiles. On some level, Crane registered that should he need to leave this room, he would now no longer have to use the door. Next, replacing the synth skin removed earlier, came the brassy sections of case-hardened Ceramol, which clamped directly to his metal bones. He felt each piece go into place, strengthening each bone, protecting the already thoroughly covered internal components with sometimes 3 centimeters thickness of the brassy material, and, strangely, linking into his cooling system. It was only when Starlek made the information available that Crane realized the Ceramol was plated with brass containing a superconducting mesh, each piece connecting to the next so that a point source of heat would be distributed all over his surface. The mesh was set in brass, which soaked up the heat from the superconductor, as Ceramol would not. The armor also contained synthetic nerves, but not nearly so many as his synth skin had contained, and this served to dull the edge of Crane's world. However, the armoring on the hands remained just as sensitive as the removed synth skin. No doubt, so that he could feel when he broke bones and stilled the beat of a heart. "That the control module they want to use?" Crane opened his eyes, dark now, with their layer of polarized chain glass, and saw the birdman gesturing to a small, black, pebble-like object his boss now held. "Yes, it can be linked in to just about any augmentation, and its link is encoded," the man replied. "I'll leave that to Angelina and her dear brother, though. Why they wanted this method of control, I don't know. Maybe, so only one person can have their finger on the button at any one time. Meanwhile..." He picked up a small remote console and pressed the pebble into a recess made for it. Crane felt the immediate connection. "Okay, Crane, I want you to move about the room while I check the link," said Starlek. When he glanced at his console, his expression became confused. "Mr. Crane?" he questioned. Mr. Crane reached up and disconnected, from the back of his head, the optic cable leading to Starlek's main console. Then, in two long strides, he was looming over Starlek and the Birdman. "How is it?" said the Birdman, then made a gulping, retching sound as Crane's armored hand closed around his throat and jerked him off the ground. The golem tilted his own head, bird-like, to one side, like this man whose legs were now kicking at the air, then closed his fist. The sound was rather like that of an apple squeezed in a press. The birdman's eyes bulged, and his tongue protruded from his beak. Then his body dropped to the floor, shortly followed by his head. Turning to Starlek, Crane flicked feathery flesh from his hand. Starlek grabbed up the console and inset module and, in panic, tried to operate its controls. As he backed to the wall, Crane followed him with short, delicate steps. "Peltus! Damn them! Oh, shit!" Crane reached down and took off Starlek's hat, placed it on his own head, and tilted it to a rakish angle. The orders Starlek was desperately inputting did nothing to counter the one Crane had already received from the module. He reached out again, took away the little console, and tossed it to one side. "No, please, no, don't!" In some part of himself, Crane was satisfied with this outcome, repayment for what they had done to him. He closed his hand on Starlek's face, lifted him up, and began to undo the man's coat. Starlek fought back, but might as well have tried to fight a stone wall. Crane stripped the coat away, held it up for inspection, then wrapped Starlek's head repeatedly against the wall until something cracked and the man ceased to struggle. This made it much easier for Crane to remove the lace-up boots and trousers. As he dressed himself, Crane noted that Starlek's heart was still beating, its thumping quite plain to the golem's superb hearing. Suitably attired now, Crane picked the man up by one ankle and inspected him. Then, as if curious to know what might be hidden inside, stabbed a hand into the man's torso and ripped out his intestines. The heartbeat stopped soon after the mess hit the floor. By then Mr. Crane had turned to the console and with bloodied brass fingers picked up the small rubber dog before, with one sweep of his arm, sending all the equipment on the table crashing to the floor. There were other things he wanted to do while awaiting the arrival of his new owner. Retroact ends. The Janetech worm had taken several microseconds to subvert the telefactors and track back to the exterior input center. Jerusalem took a considerably shorter time to recognize that this tardiness was not some subterfuge to put a victim off guard, but because, without a guiding intelligence, the attack was slower. This fact, and because Jerusalem did not want certain conclusions further delayed, had for the present saved the lives of the scientists still working inside exterior input. Had the worm been as fast as Jerusalem knew was possible with Jane Tech, the AI would have had to fusion incinerate that particular area of itself, rather than take the time to eject the center. Now the sealed chamber, like a section of a great iron nautilus, tumbled away, trailing severed optics and ducts, while Jerusalem watched it through many eyes, some of them the sights of missile launchers, lasers, and particle beam projectors. In fact, the worm's promulgation through the telefactor systems had not been so much an attack as a tentative probe, for attack would presuppose a guiding intelligence. The technology was searching for new directions in which to grow, rather like a creeping vine. Jerusalem toyed with this comparison, considering how Jane Tech, like a fig vine, could strangle its host. But no, it was more of a plague technology. The AI then amused itself by making statistical comparisons between the extrapolated spread of Jane Tech on Earth and other historical plagues on the same planet. Should this particular Pandora affliction get out of control, the one most closely resembling it might be the flu epidemic that World War I soldiers brought back with them from the trenches. Then again, that comparison was not so close either. Piqued, Jerusalem instead turned the bulk of its attention inward. The bridge pod of the Occam razor was still rendering up reams of information, but there were subtle differences between the Jane Tech there and that seeded on the asteroid. Still working by analogy, Jerusalem felt these were the differences between wild and cultivated plants, the latter representing the tech in the bridge pod, or perhaps wild and trained animals. Certainly the tech in the pod had appeared more purposeful in its growth, guided first by Skellor and then by the Afrin entity. It was purposeful under Afrin's control still, though very slow now at the low temperature Jerusalem held it. But, analogies aside, all the information was there, and this recent ejection of exterior input had delayed Acelis Mica and those the AI had deliberately assembled around her from reaching certain conclusions. Jerusalem allowed itself a silicon sigh, and, despite being aware that impatience was one step towards singularity, which would be both nirvana and death to it, wished that the humans, hymens, and lesser AIs would just get a move on and work it all out. The force field wall behind her now, Arden pulled a melon-shaped object out of her backpack and depressed a control on the end of it before tossing it on the ground. Stretching out spines with a wrinkled material connecting them, the object spread, pulled the material taut, and began to bulge upward into a dome. The spine ends then stabbed down into the earth or sought out rock crevices. Within a minute, the ground tent Dragon had created for her was secure. The thing was always warm to the touch, and inside it was white and like a reptile's gullet. It was a living thing, and she remembered how, when first receiving it, she had taken a long time to pluck up the courage to sleep inside it, fearing it might, one day, decide she would provide more nutrients than the ground into which it rooted. Sitting down before the tent, Arden took out some other scaly packages. One was a flask that provided hot coffee, and, so long as she kept it topped up with water, it would continue providing for a number of days. Once the coffee started to taste a little rank, it was time to drop the flask down the nearest hole for one of Dragon's pseudopods to retrieve. A second package's only function was to keep fresh the sandwiches she had made earlier, though the bread and the fillings had been provided by other draconic biomachines. She ate her ham sandwiches and drank hot coffee, while the sun grew bloated and orange on the horizon. Then, deciding the light was just about right, she took out her holocap, turned it on, and listened to the whine as its small U-charger topped up its lithium batteries. Eventually, the ready light came on, and she pulled out the device's monocle and tossed it away from her. The little glassy object began to spin and make a whining sound as it rose 10 meters into the air. Arden folded up a mini-screen from the main device and, using a small pointer detached from the side of it, began scrolling down her alphabetically arranged menu. Shortly she came to Slear 1 to 5 Transform and selected it. Below the spinning monocle, like something invisible being pumped full of dye, a first-stage slear appeared, then began to grow. Observing this, Arden again contemplated building in something that showed the creature shedding its carapace or encysting, and each subsequent growth spurt. But the holocap's memory space was beginning to get a little crowded. The 10-legged slear expanded and transformed to its second stage. The body segment behind its head rode up and melded into its head, with the legs attached to it turning into carapace sores. Compound eyes simultaneously sprouted above its mouth, and a vicious ovipositor extruded from the creature's back end. It continued to grow, its legs getting longer, raising it higher off the ground, and its carapace darkening. Transforming to the third stage, it took its new forelegs off the ground, and they too rode up beside the nightmare head, shedding complex toes and turning into pincers. Now it was left with only 6 feet on the ground, and it was also becoming more angular and darker, like something fashioned of wrought iron. By the fourth stage, it had become a black, hard-shelled monster. Watching this turn into the fifth stage, Arden opined to herself that now, walking on two legs, it was like the worst of all monsters. Then she cancelled the image and called up one she had recently captured of the Droon, and as night descended, she continued spending happy hours watching such nightmares dance around her campsite. At sunset, Anderson began to get anxious. They had not seen any of the signs of the roadhouse LaForge had described to them, and had not yet reached the end of the vegetative area. And because of this, he knew that nighttime activity would be frenetic, and that he and Turgle would not be getting much sleep. Also, the speed at which everything was growing meant that by morning the trail left by that brass man would be erased, and probably he would be much further ahead of them anyway, for Anderson did not reckon he stopped to rest during the hours of darkness. "Best we set ourselves a camp for the night," he finally conceded. Turgle looked about dubiously, but it would be dark in less than an hour, and there was no guarantee they would find anywhere better within that time. Quickly they dismounted, trampled down an area of vegetation and set up their camp. After eating biscuits and preserved sand oysters, they took turns on watch, though neither of them got much sleep. Such was the lethal activity all around them. At midnight, with Ogygian sliding above them like an indifferent steel angel, a quake loosened one of the electric fence's posts, and a second stager managed to knock it over. Anderson abruptly discovered how effective was his metallier carbine. It juddered in his hand, flash blinding him in the night, the whole clip from it cutting the sleer in half from mouth to tail. It had not been his intention to fire on automatic, but in the frantic scramble there had been no time to check. "I think it's dead," said Turgle. Anderson stood blinking after images from his eyes, his weapon empty. As his vision finally cleared, he saw that Turgle held his automatic, pointing straight at his, Anderson's, face. There was a certain inevitability about this, since Anderson could not be forever on his guard. After a significant pause, Turgle lowered the weapon and holstered it, then went to heave the sleer off the fence and set the post back up. Something significant had changed, and now there was trust between them. Nevertheless, both he and Turgle were tired and miserable come dawn, and set out in desultory silence. For most of the morning, Anderson did not detect the brass man's trail, and felt sure that in this tangle of canyons it was permanently lost. This sank him into a blacker mood. Then, with a smacking sound, Bonehead abruptly extruded its feeding head and began emitting a low grunting. A wild sandhog, smaller even than Turgle's mount, was now setting up the same racket as Bonehead and leapt high into the air, then fled ahead of them with something white clutched underneath it. Neither Anderson nor Turgle tried to divert their mounts from investigating the rest of the white remains. "Kilnsman Gyrol, that Golgoth policeman, said something about strange creatures out this way," said the knight. The young sandhog had snatched the two-legged breeder's segments, which were easily torn away from the rest of this albino sleer with its sapphire eyes, now pinned to the ground with one of its own torn-off pincers. "Our brass friend did this," suggested Turgle. As their two mounts eased out their combined sensory and feeding heads to feast on this carrion, Anderson replied, "Certainly looks that way. Just as it would seem, he is also heading for the plains. So there's no need for me to find his trail. I'm sure we'll meet again." And, as if this statement suddenly cleared a black cloud, he looked up and saw one of the signs LaForge had mentioned, carved into the face of the nearest butte. He pointed to it. "Anyway, no hurry now, and we do need to rest after last night." Turgle glanced up, puzzled for a moment, then grinning. Following the directions given by each of the signs, the two travellers eventually came upon a concrete road running between the buttes, then the metallier village called Grit, with its station and roadhouse. Against a sandstone cliff face, globular houses were raised up on frameworks above hog corrals, warehouses and enclosures for domesticated rock lice. Here there were cars, like they had earlier seen in the city, but not so many, perhaps because the concrete road ended within sight of this place. Soon they had left Stone and Bonehead in a corral, munching on nicely stinking carrion, and were walking through a market towards the roadhouse's access stair. "Busy place." Turgle was eyeing a stall displaying sand oysters, dried gulper meat, Suleiman pods and trays of writhing cliff eels. Pointing to the far end of the road, where men were shoveling sand and cement into the rumbling drums of mixers, Anderson explained, "For the road crews," then gestured to treaded vehicles like the one owned by the mineraliers they had encountered. "And the mineraliers. Lot of useful ores to be found in the area, I hear." After dumping their gear in rooms paid for with some of Anderson's newly acquired focells, they wandered out to a busy bar and cafeteria, which opened on one side onto a balcony overlooking the village. "Oh, dear," said Anderson, spotting Unger Salbeck enjoying a meal inside. He quickly backed out of the room. This could get complicated. "Tell the local kilnsmen," advised Turgle belligerently, then suddenly looked confused. "I'll be going back to my room now," said Anderson, amused. How righteous the boy was becoming, after having promised never to thieve again. But he did not know the full story, and Anderson had always valued prudence. The re-entry pod was soon glowing red-hot as it arced into atmosphere at 20,000 kilometers per hour. Slowed to its terminal velocity by increasing air density, it punched through cloud cover, leaving a vapor trail scar, and used up all its small supply of hydrogen fuel in one decelerating burn. Then it blew its back hatch, releasing a monomer drogue to slow its descent further. 50 kilometers above the ground, the outer shell separated and spun away, taking the drogue with it, whereupon the telefactor it had contained descended on AG. Planing on the gravity field, it fled across sandy flatlands. This barren landscape soon became broken up like a diseased skin by gulches, arroyos, and canyons in ever greater complexity, until soon there were more of these than there was of the plain itself, and the telefactor was flying over a landscape clustered with sandstone buttes. Directed by its controlling intelligence, the machine finally descended into a long canyon to hover over a long, straight scar in the ground. Its dishes whirling and other sensors extruded and functioning at 100%, it followed the course of this track to where it ended just before heaped sandstone rubble. Nothing else was visible to any of those sensors in any spectrum, until the machine was nearly upon the pile of stone. Then, all at once, the maggot-shaped survey ship, the Vulture, suddenly became visible. The telefactor halted, backed up, and, observing the ship fade seemingly out of existence at the chameleon-ware field's interface, it advanced again. The airlock was no problem for the little machine, as Jack had amply provided it with just about every safe-breaking tool known to man, and some unknown. With the outer door now open, it entered the lock and began drilling through the inner door. Soon it had extracted a 10-centimeter circle of sandwiched hull composite, insulation, and ceramol. Discarding this, it then extruded a sensor through the hole and into the ship, scanning its interior. A minute later, it rose back out of the lock, then out of the canyon, and at maximum speed hurtled back towards the plain. The space around the planet was scattered with such vast numbers of U-space transceivers and detection devices that one had even been picked up by the Jack Ketch's collision detector, and destroyed by auto-laser as the ship surfaced from underspace. So Jack knew any attempt at concealment would be wasted, and immediately went into close orbit of the inhabited planet. Within minutes he spotted the signs of a crash landing, and now, after sending a telefactor to check, knew that Skellor was not aboard the Vulture or anywhere in its vicinity. Nor could any link be made with the little ship's AI, so it was probably dead. Had Skellor been aboard, Jack's subsequent actions would have diverged only a little, in that he would not have waited for the telefactor to get safely out of the way. The AI even considered delaying until Cormac was out of cold sleep, but calculated that the agent's orders would not conflict. The Vulture, though damaged, still offered someone of Skellor's capabilities a possible escape route. Its own AI was not present, and there were the products of dangerous Jane technology aboard. End of discussion. An imploder missile was out of the question. Such weapons were only suitable to use against objects in vacuum, where there was no material medium to carry the resultant shockwave further. Even the smallest such missile available in the Jack Ketcher's arsenal could level a square kilometre, cause massive ground winds, kill thousands of the humans scattered throughout the surrounding area, and probably even flip over that platform city nearby. No. Not good. Earth Central would not be pleased at such a disregard for human life, even if the humans concerned were not members of the polity. Searching through his weapons carousels, Jack selected precisely what was required, and as Cormac and his fellow humans blearily recovered from thaw up, spat from one of his nacelles a small black missile, carrying a slow-burn CTD warhead, which would provide a controlled reaction hotter than the surface of a sun. Standing on the remaining rickety section of a Manis-bonded fibre scaffold, Chandle peered into and through the butte. They had mined out every last scrap of the blue sand, which was rarer than the white, and now the butte was sliced clean through, the many tons of sandstone above the slice supported by a Manis poles and trusses. In a parent's time, mining like this had always been the most efficient way. But now, with the quakes, it was becoming increasingly risky. Not for the first time, she decided she must find some other method or some other profession. The blue sand itself they loaded into the coke trailer, with a tarpaulin pulled over it, having earlier stacked the coke in one of the now cold kilns. Though Chandle did not hold out much hope that it would still be here should they ever return to this spot. The finished focels went in boxes on the flatbed trailer. In all, it had been a tiring few months, and the increased slear activity and vegetative growth in the canyons provided a welcome excuse to finish for most of them. Though, of course, Dornick was already muttering about some workers' percentages being too high. Chandle, after her creepy encounter only a few days before, was glad to get away. She wanted to be where there were always lots of people around her, and to get back to practical concerns. Ghosts wandering among the sand towers were not much to her liking.
"Shall I do it now?" asked Dornick.
Chandle nodded and watched him duck inside the mine workings to set fire to the encampment rubbish they had jammed in there. As the pile began to smoke, then the constant breeze dragged the flames horizontally through the exposed workings, he and Chandle scrambled down the scaffolding and rejoined the rest of the mineraliers on the ground. Together, they all heaved on the scaffold until it crashed over on its side. Then they quickly dragged it clear of the butte and stood back to watch the conflagration. For safety's sake, mineraliers had always collapsed their used mine workings, because the Amanus beams would become worm-chewed within a season, leaving them a possible death trap. though Chandle wondered if there was any need for that now. After the first worms got into the wood, a quake would surely finish the job. With a furnace glow in the slice cut through the butte, eventually something began to crackle. Then the top layers of sandstone slammed down to crush the burning wood, effectively snuffing out the fire.
"Get that scaffolding disassembled and loaded," Dornick instructed.
But soon this was done, and they were on their way. The steam-driven cargo carrier chuffing ahead on its caterpillar tracks, towing mobile quarters and the flatbed trailer. Then three big old sandhogs following behind, hauling three more trailers.
"Be nice to get to grit before full dark."
Chandle peered up at the open sky from the passenger seat while Dornick drove the carrier. Briefly, she wondered about the straight line of cloud she could see, picked out clearly by the setting sun. But never having seen a vapor trail before, she dismissed it from her thoughts.
"Sure be no problem, but we'll be well into the night unloading this lot,"
Dornick replied.
"We may as well..." "What the hell?"
Suddenly, it was as bright as day, brighter even. Over to their left, a swirling column of fire rose into the sky. The ground began to vibrate, and in a matter of seconds, the gentle breeze turned into a gale. Dornick drew the carrier to a halt. Chandle looked back to see the three sandhogs dropping down on their belly plates. Then she faced back into the wind, blinking her nictitating membranes to clear sand from her eyes, and watched the column of fire swirling tighter and tighter. Then the wind died abruptly, and she was unable to get her breath. Then suddenly the airflow reversed. Gasping, Chandle watched the fiery column drop down behind the buttes and extinguish.
"Volcanic?"
Dornick eventually suggested. It took Chandle a moment to remember what that word meant. It occurred in the official Mineralia lexicon, but they had never needed to use it until recently, just like earthquake or tremor.
"Could be.
The quake epicenter is supposedly somewhere out in this direction. Let's take a look."
"That a good idea?"
She gazed at him. If it was volcanic, who's to know what might have been brought to the surface? She turned to the rest of her group and shouted,
"Keep heading on to grit. We'll join you later."
Dornick set their carrier trundling down a side canyon, while the sandhogs and their trailers continued on to grit. Within an hour, they reached the source of the fire. Climbing down from the carrier, they moved as close as the latent heat would allow.
"Not volcanic," decided Chandle.
She poked her toe at a globule of glass, then wished she hadn't when her footwear began to smoke. The crater, extending about 50 meters across, shimmered under a heat haze as its lining of molten glass cooled. A butte standing at the crater's edge had half melted away, its inward face still glowing too.
"Maybe a meteor?"
Chandle was groping for another explanation, but she wished she did not feel so damned sure this had something to do with that spectral visitor to their camp, and that it was no natural phenomenon at all. Chapter 15. Why do the AIs put up with us? It could be but the work of a few decades for them to exterminate us, and they don't even have to do that. Space is big, so they could just abandon us to our fate and head off elsewhere to create some halcyon AI realm. The answer, as it always is in such circumstances, is both simple and complex. To ask why the AIs have not exterminated us is to suppose that only humans create moralities and live by rules. They do not destroy us because they think and feel that to do so would be wrong. Perhaps just as humans felt it wrong to drive to extinction the closely related apes. As to them abandoning us, well, many of them do leave the polity, but then so do many humans. The truth is that their motivations and consequent behaviour patterns are much like our own. For being first created by us, they are just the next stage of us, the next evolutionary step. It is also true that with hymens and human memcording, it becomes increasingly difficult to define the line that has been stepped over. And in the end, to ask the initial question is to put yourself in the gutter and AI upon a pedestal. Uncomfortable positions for both. From Quince Guide, compiled by humans. Anderson blessed both the industry and the inventiveness of the Metaliers. Water pumped up from a borehole to tanks on top of the butte to the rear of the roadhouse ran during the day through solar panels. And now, the simple luxury of turning on a hot water tap. As his bath filled, he took off his boots, unbuckled his armor plates, then stripped off his padded undersuit, which he dropped in a basket by the door for laundering. He was ready to dip his stinking foot into the water when there came a knock at his door. "That you, Turgle?" he asked. "No, it's Unger Salbeck," replied the voice from without. With a sigh, Anderson wrapped a towel around his waist and looked at the Metalier handgun on the bed. The sudden déjà vu he felt was almost painful. The first time had been 5 years ago, when he was stripping off his armour inside a Mineralia hut so he could find out just exactly where the Salbeck boy had stabbed him. Dressings were laid out ready for him, and a steaming bath. He remembered the occasion well. "Who is it?" "I am Unger Salbeck." Fusile quickly up and braced against his hip. He had kept it loaded. "What do you want?" Anderson pulled the hammer back and advanced to the door.
"I want to talk to you about my brother."
"What's to say? He committed crimes, knowing the penalties, and he paid. Have you come to tell me how he was really a good boy and had been sadly misled?"
Anderson leant forward and flipped the latch over with the barrel of his gun, then rapidly moved back and to one side. Unger Salbeck opened the door and stepped into the room. She seemed not to be carrying weapons, so perhaps only a tongue-lashing was to come. But then, he considered, she probably had a gun tucked into the back of her loose trousers, concealed by her tunic. "Ugh, any moment now," he thought, as she reached back to close the door and latch it.
He went on. "The other one I get often is how poor the criminal's family was, and how with money he or she would never have turned to crime, which I've always considered insulting to those poor people who graft all their lives without putting a foot wrong."
There was no denying that, barring her resemblance to her sociopathic brother, Unger Salbeck was an alluring woman. Her brown hair was tied back from a wide but attractive face, and since she was of Metalier ancestry, she was without lip tendrils or wrist spurs. Also, Anderson couldn't help but notice the unrestricted movement beneath her tunic.
"You're right. It is insulting," she said, moving in from the door. From childhood, I trained in the husbandry and breaking in of sand hogs, and only last month was I finally considered competent. I have supported my parents and Quirst. He repaid me by trying to rape me, and when I beat him off with a thurial hook, he went and found my best friend Ellison to rape and murder instead. I'm not here for vengeance, Anderson Endrick. I'm here to thank you.
She shrugged and gave him a deprecating grin. It all sounded so plausible. But that same plausibility was the reason he required the dressings. Foolishly, he had thought the boy Quirst would run, when in fact he had waited in ambush. Anderson intended never to repeat such mistakes.
I'd like to believe you, but you'll understand my caution.
I am unarmed, she said, holding her hands out from her body.
So you say.
You don't believe me? Anderson shrugged. Very well.
Unger reached up to the neck of her tunic and dipped forward to tug it off over her head. She kicked off the sandals she wore, undid the cord of her trousers, and dropped them to her ankles, stepping out of them. Now completely naked, she moved closer to Anderson and turned one complete circle.
See? No weapons.
His mouth feeling a little arid, Anderson stared at her plump breasts, then down at her shaven crotch. He noted the wheel tattooed over her belly button, a Metalia sign, and the curved scar on her thigh. This last decided him, for it was the kind of mark received from the sharp edge of a young sandhog's carapace. Clicking his fusile's hammer down, he put the weapon aside.
Now, let me really thank you, she had said. And so she had.
Returning to the present, Anderson realized he had a raging erection. It had ever been thus, and he cursed his treacherous body.
The latch is off, he said.
Unger Salbeck stepped into the room, a touch of grey in her hair and the angles of her face somewhat harsher.
Did you think you could keep on avoiding me?
I've managed to do so for a year, Anderson replied.
She eyed the towel around his waist. But I can see you're glad to see me.
I'm filthy and I need a bath, he said.
She stepped up close, pulled his towel away, then reached down to close her hand around his penis and slowly began to rub it.
It's a big tub. I'm sure there's room for the both of us.
Anderson sighed. One way or another, he had been running away from this woman for the last 5 years, and she knew how to catch him every time. Cormac had never before come out of cold sleep with a stinking headache, and he realized that his reaction to Jack's news could perhaps have been a bit more positive. But after he applied an analgesic patch, his headache faded and he began to see reason.
I understand why you zapped the vulture, said Thorne, sitting in one of the club chairs, but doing it straight away will have given him ample warning we are here.
He looked better now, comfortable in ECS fatigues and not hallucinating, as Cormac felt sure he must have been shortly after his surgery. What he had seen was not possible, surely. With a degree of unease, Cormac remembered something similar happening with Blegg on the Occam razor. But of course, that just wasn't the same. Still pacing, Cormac replied before the AI did. Those swarms of U-space sentinels probably aren't all dragons, so Skellar would have detected us the moment we entered this system. He looked up at the view displayed
of the sandy planet, wrapped in pearly scarves of cloud. The first ECS imperative was to make sure Skeller doesn't get away. Jack acted on that, even if in doing so he destroyed something we might have used as a trap. He glanced across. Acento and Gant entered the bridge, shortly followed by Fethan. Then added a little acidly, I suspect the larger AI view is that once Skellor's contained, he can be destroyed at leisure, and that any collateral damage will come into the calculation later.
It's like Masada, Thorne observed.
How so?
Like Masada only turned about. Skellor wanted to capture you there. He destroyed what he thought were all means of transportation from the surface, then sent in his hunters, but with no great urgency, because he knew he could burn the entire planet down to the bedrock any time he liked.
Is that how you feel about it, Jack? Cormac asked, turning to the automaton sitting in its club chair.
There are humans down there, said the hangman.
That wasn't what I asked, but never mind. What about Dragon?
Over the plain, adjacent to where I destroyed Skellor's ship, a hardfield dome has been erected. It's 10 kilometres in diameter, but of no great height. The Dragon's sphere is probably underneath it, underground. I surmise this because that particular point is the epicentre of a gravity phenomenon.
What? Asked Cormac.
Gravity waves are being generated from there, causing earthquakes throughout the area.
Cormac wondered how the hell he was supposed to factor that in. A Dragon sphere underground, playing around with Gravtech. He decided things were complicated enough already.
Go on, he said.
Jack continued.
Also, one of my telefactors is approaching the area, and I've already detected subterranean tunnel systems similar to those first found around Dragon on Aster Calora.
Have you tried communicating? Cormac asked.
Only light penetrates the barrier. I've tried using message lasers, but get no response.
Could Skellor be inside that barrier? Gant asked.
Maybe you'll need to put a few slow burners through the plane as well, and maybe a couple of imploders, just in case.
More likely Dragon erected it to keep Skellor out, said Cormac. We know Dragon has as much liking of Jane technology as you have of Dragon itself, Gant.
Then where is Skellor? Interjected Thorne.
Jack? Cormac asked.
I am scanning from here, and four more of my telefactors are quartering the whole area, but I have not yet located him,
the AI replied.